is United States against Billings. Ms. Murphy-Petros.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Melissa Murphy-Petros on behalf of the defendant appellant, Darnell Billings. Reversal is required here for two reasons. First, it is well established that the government may not withhold the filing of a substantial assistance motion for any reason not rationally related to a legitimate government end. In other words, the government's decision with respect to whether to make or withhold the motion has to be based on the defendant's actual assistance and nothing more. Here, the only plausible inference from the record is that the government based its decision on improper factors.
But isn't there a prior problem? In some of these systems, the defendant's effort to provide assistance, whether or not real assistance is provided, is relevant. But for 3553E, as I understand it, he actually has to assist. I mean, what he says has to be useful. And I thought he had conceded that he really didn't have anything useful to put on the table. So in some ways, we don't even need to reach whether he was being forthcoming or truthful or whatever. If he didn't have anything that would help the government shouldn't file the motion, and I thought that he's conceded that.
I don't know that Mr. Billings' defense counsel conceded that point, although he certainly did make the point, which leads to our second argument, that Mr. Billings attempted to help the government to the very best of his ability, given the fact that he had been incarcerated from August 13th.
Responsive to Judge Wood's question, which is, didn't he actually have to have useful information? Good faith, but not having useful information is not enough, is it?
I mean, I'm looking at the statute. The statute says, so as to reflect a defendant's substantial assistance in the investigation or prosecution of another person. And the interesting thing is that there's a contrast in other areas where the Sentencing Commission and others have seen fit to reward efforts to assist, even for the person like Mr. Billings, who's perhaps just no longer able to be helped.
The safety valve, for example, says if you tell everything you know, you get the safety valve, even if you don't know anything of value. But that's not the way this works, so far as I can see.
Yes. I think the point again here, though, is that we really don't know what Mr. Billings did and how it fell short. He was certainly entitled to that. What we know is this.
Entitled to that.
Excuse me, Your Honor. He was entitled to know what it was about his efforts that fell short.
This is not covered by the Administrative Procedure Act. The U.S. Attorney doesn't have to write a memorandum explaining himself to the court any more than the U.S. Attorney has to write a memorandum explaining his charging decisions. APA action.
And I would say, I mean, the U.S. attorney does say, I don't think you provided substantial assistance. So he knows that much. Now, have argued that that's a conclusory kind of statement, but I haven't seen any cases that have required chapter, book, and verse about why the U.S. attorney, indeed, it might compromise investigations. There are all sorts of good reasons why we might not want to impose that burden on the U.S. attorney.
Yes, I think that you're right, and I think we're certainly struggling with a limited record here. But the record does make clear that the U.S. attorney did make what we have argued is a conclusory statement, although he was able to provide numerous details about matters that were unrelated to sentencing, as we've argued in our brief. That at least gives rise to a suspicion that perhaps the attorney's decision was based on improper factors, and certainly with a mandatory life sentence at stake.
What you say is we've got suspicions, therefore we want discovery. And, of course, that that line of argument is made a lot where somebody argues selective prosecution. And you know the Supreme Court's resolution of that. It is, no, that's not a basis for discovery. You actually have to have in hand a prima facie case of a constitutional violation before discovery can begin. Now, I know defendants don't like that, but those are the rules. You don't have a prima facie case in hand here.
Yes, I understand, Your Honor.
And I guess another way to approach the issue I'm having with your position, and I sympathize with you, is this phrase in Wade that talks about, we all can understand an unconstitutional motive. You're not relying on that ground. But a prosecutor's refusal that's not rationally related to any legitimate government end. What does that mean? How active an appellate, well, first of all, how active a role should the district court take in assessing that? How active a role is there for an appellate court? You've cited cases where courts of appeals have remanded because of a concern about that. It's language that we didn't make up. It's from the Supreme Court. But on the other hand, it has not been seen as an invitation for meticulous review of these decisions.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, again, I think certainly in this circumstance where we have so many details about improper factors and so few details about the defendant's efforts, that certainly the defendant was entitled to a hearing to determine what it was that fell short. Again, this is a very grave situation. He was facing a mandatory life sentence. He had initially pled not guilty and then a year later changed his plea to guilty based on what the U.S. Attorney Bass described as a cooperation agreement in August of 2006. I think he certainly is entitled to more information with respect to why his efforts fell short. Our second point, as we touched on briefly a few minutes ago, is with respect to defendant's incarcerated status. Defendant had a right to know that his incarcerated status would make it difficult, if not impossible, for him to provide the level of assistance that would be satisfactory to the government so as to warrant the motion. And again, the only plausible inference from the record is that this did not happen. Defense counsel argued below, the government did not dispute then, nor does it dispute now, that defendant's abilities to assist the government were hampered by his long incarceration. Again, he was arrested and pled not guilty in August of 2005. A year later, he changed his plea to guilty on the basis of a cooperation agreement, which presumably had as its goal enough assistance to warrant the motion. When the government entered this agreement with him, it had an obligation to give him full information, and that information would include the impact of his incarcerated status.
Isn't that perfectly evident to him? I mean, he pleads. He knows he's been in jail for a year, so he knows he's been off the street. I have no idea to what extent, you know, he's received visitors. Some people might be keeping up. Some people may be part of a big enough network that there are still useful things. But he, to tell him, you know, you've been in jail for a year, so you might not know as much as you did before, seems to me unnecessary.
I think it's perfectly evident in hindsight. I don't know that it was perfectly evident to Mr. Billings at the time. Obviously, he knew he had been in jail. I mean, that goes without saying. Did he know that his abilities would be hampered and that that hampering would therefore impact the government's evaluation of what he was able to do? I think it's would be very reasonable for him to say, well, I know I'm in jail. The government knows I'm in jail. I'll do my best. And I think it'd be very reasonable to think that doing his best under his circumstances would warrant consideration by the government. And certainly if that's not the case, then the government has an obligation to say that at a time where he could certainly, you know, withdraw his plea and take his chances at trial if he so chooses. I will rest on my brief at this point, but thank you. We do request reversal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. It seems to me that the problem in this case is essentially what counsel wants is to look at everything in hindsight. The problem is there is no evidence to support any of the claims that the defendant wishes to make on appeal. What they really want is, I think Judge Easterbrook said it, is they want an opportunity to go back to the district court and discover some of these factors. But the record, the evidence before this court, doesn't warrant any remand to the district court. There is nothing in this record that suggests that the government did anything with an improper motive or did anything to mislead or confuse Mr. Billings into doing something that he didn't wish to do.
I think what the defendant is arguing, essentially, though, is that, number one, this rationally related language does invite some appellate review. And so, just to take an example, you know, did the government refuse to make the substantial assistance motion because Mr. Billings was 27 years old with 10 children from 6 different women? Now, that has nothing whatsoever to do with how much assistance he's given or hasn't given. And if that were the government's reason for refusing to file the motion, maybe that is something that's not rationally related.
And I would totally agree with you, Your Honor, if there was any evidence to support that. First off, the record...
Well, the prosecutor mentioned it, so that's some evidence. I didn't make it up.
No, but where the prosecutor mentioned it, I think, is what you should look at, Your Honor.
Well,
there was
addition,
a long discussion...
You said there's no evidence, and I'm telling you that on the record there is something that could cause somebody to think that was a motivation.
In the context of all of the discussion about whether or not the government was going to make a motion under 3553E, the only thing the government said was that in its view, the assistance that Mr. Billings had provided did not rise to the level of substantial assistance. In its sentencing recommendations to the court, it did mention the fact that Mr. Billings had a lot of children, but what it said was it was sad. It wasn't a reflection on his... A bad reflection on him and why he couldn't cooperate or provide substantial assistance. It was in the context of what a sad case it was that a man as young as Mr. Billings was going to spend the rest of his life in prison as a result of his conviction in this case. So I think
it's kind of said in a double-edged way. I'm sad to say he has managed at age 27 to have 10 children from 6 different women, all of whom will now be without a father. Well, you know, in our society, 6 different women, 10 children. I mean, there's a bit of criticism in there, too.
I take what you're saying, Your Honor. I don't know. I wasn't the prosecutor who said that. I don't know what the prosecutor had in his mind. I certainly see that someone who reads that language could possibly come to that. But still, the comment was not made in the connection of a motion for 3553E.
After the discussion. I understand that.
Okay. And I guess the other thing that it seems to me is that Mr. Billings had gone, this was his second lawyer. He had fired his public defender and hired a private attorney. Now, he had gone out and reached another attorney that he wanted to deal with, who was going to deal with the government. Mr. Billings himself was quite capable of communicating with the court. He filed pro se motions. In fact, he filed a motion for downward departure on his own for what he called substantial or substandard housing because of his pretrial detention 4 days before his sentencing. So my point is neither Mr.
He wasn't complaining that the housing was too expensive.
No, that's right. He wanted to be in the MCC rather than in a county jail in central Illinois. But I guess my point is nowhere in the record ever did Mr. Billings or his lawyer raise anything with regard to an ill motive on the part of the government. They never disputed the fact that the information that Mr. Billings provided had not risen to the level of substantial assistance. And that's, it seems to me, is a burden that's just simply insurmountable for the defendant in this case.
Well, why didn't the government provide more information to the court on the scope and level of cooperation that he provided?
Your Honor, I'd say because they weren't asked to. If almost every case that comes before this court in the context of the government not making a 3553E motion comes when the defendant has made a motion to compel the government or to make further inquiry of the government or something of that sort. This is a case where they were never asked. The government was never asked to provide any additional information. So it seems to me that, as Judge Wood pointed out earlier, oftentimes we're very circumspect on the information that we provide. and with regard to when we are making a substantial assistance motion. So it wouldn't be unusual if we're not asked that we're not going to volunteer what the defendant didn't do.
Now, both parties have agreed that, you know, there was no allocution here. Both parties have agreed that's harmless error. Do you think that Billings could have said something during the allocution that could have shed light on the type of assistance he provided?
I mean, Your Honor, I can't say that he couldn't have, but he was never foreclosed from the ability to do that. As I said, he filed his own motion within days of his sentencing. If he thought that, you know, that he still hadn't been able to provide substantial assistance to the government, I think he was an articulate person who could have provided that information to the court. I don't think he was waiting for his chance and was somehow denied his chance to speak. Obviously, though, I can't say that. I understand he did not get his right to allocution. Of course, he was facing a life sentence, so I don't know. Quite frankly, since he was facing the life sentence, and the only way that the judge could have gone away from that life sentence was on the government's motion, I can't believe Mr. Billings could have said something in his own allocution that would have caused the government at that point to file the motion that would have allowed the judge to go below the mandatory life sentence, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, then I'd rest on my brief. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Anything further, Ms. Murphy-Petros?
Just one very quick point. With respect to Your Honor's question as to why the government did not provide more information about Mr. Billings' efforts, I would just like to draw your attention to the transcript of May 25th, 07, which is at pages 24 and 25, where U.S. Attorney Bruce is describing what we contend are the improper factors, but he does say, Your Honor, I can't provide any more details because I'm standing in for Mr. Bass. This is not my case. Mr. Bruce simply may not have had all the information available to him to afford Mr. Billings the information that he was certainly entitled to, and again, we request reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Murphy-Petros, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance both to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.